This is Dan Austin at the home of Jack Tighe, T-I-G-H-E, in Pompano Beach, Florida. The date is Friday, August the 2nd, 1991. And Jack, I'm pleased that we finally were able to get together for this interview for the Baseball Hall of Fame, and thank you for saying yes to this invitation. Baseball has lots of sea stories, which I'm sure we'll get to, but you've had a illustrious career. You enjoy the game today, still go out and scout some. Would you tell us when you were born, where, your parents' names, and how you got interested, probably as a kid, in the great game of baseball?
All right, Dan. I was born in Kearney, New Jersey, August 9th, 1913. My mother's name was Clara. She came from an illustrious baseball family, had a brother in the big leagues. And my father's name was Thomas, who was a better ball player in his youth, they told me, than I was. Mm-hmm. But in those days, getting to be a ball player wasn't the easiest thing in the world, and he pursued other means to take care of his family. As I just mentioned, I had an uncle in the big leagues, and naturally, everything in our family was baseball, baseball, baseball. That was all I ever played, and it eventually became something good for me.
And that uncle is Dots Miller?
Dots Miller. Uh-huh. Played for the Pittsburgh Pirates from 1909 to, 1914, in that area. He played second base when Hannes Wagner was the shortstop.
Mm-hmm. That great double play combination.
Pretty good combination, they tell me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know him too well. I was 10 years old when he died. Mm-hmm. But he died after managing in the Coast League for 1 year, and people had predicted a tremendous managerial career for him, but fate didn't allow it. Mm-hmm.
So baseball surrounded your family. Your dad encouraged you to go out and a lot of sandlot ball in New Jersey. And so you probably did that when you quit wearing diapers, up until some scouts saw you hustling around and say, we want that guy.
My dad followed me around on weekends, sat right behind I was a catcher, incidentally, sat right behind home plate, and tried to give me advice, which sometimes I listened to, of course. But when you give advice where everybody else can hear it, sometimes you've got to ignore it. But he was for me to be a ball player, and it turned out that way. Never too much as a performing ball player. The Lord gave me a little more mental ability than he did physical ability, and people saw that early in my career and made me a manager.
Okay. You did play in the minor leagues.
I played in Charleston, West Virginia. Incidentally, I was signed in 1935, which was a long time ago, by a scout named Billy Doyle. And he signed me in the morning, and he signed a fellow in the afternoon named John Gorsica. I'm sure that'll ring a bell with a lot of people. And John became a pretty good major league pitcher. Some scouts go all their life looking for a player, and he mm-hmm. found two in a matter of 3 hours.
Yeah, that's right. And you were about 22 years old then.
I was.
You were kind of old then. Were you
yes,
an older player
yes,
to be signed
yes,
at that time?
Yes, I was.
So you really, up until after you got out of high school, you played a lot of ball in New Jersey, and some scouts picked you up. And age 22, you decided to try to make a living by playing ball.
That's right. That's right.
What kind of bonus was it? $50,000? $60,000?
I got zilch.
You got zilch. You had the honor of writing your name on a contract.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Who owned your contract?
Detroit.
Detroit.
The amazing thing, I signed with Detroit in 1935 and went out. I didn't go out that year, I went out the following year. And was with them my entire career except for a 3-year span in there during the war. Mm-hmm. And 56 some odd years.
Yeah. 56 years with nearly the same organization.
Right.
Well, I doubt if, I was thinking right offhand, the only person I know that even begins rival that would be Phil Rizzuto, who as a player, announcer, has been with the Yankees since, 1940 or 1939. So you're probably at the top of the class then when it comes to with one club. So you went to Charleston. What league was that?
That was in the Middle Atlantic League.
What class of ball?
That was C, okay. Class C. In those days it was D, C, B, A, double A in the big leagues.
Okay. Anymore, I think Class A is the in the rookie league, and that's
today,
it.
Today, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just a shade higher than what you would call the rookie league today. Uh-huh.
And you signed up as a catcher?
As a catcher. Wasn't too big, but was very aggressive. And the next year I went to the Texas League with Beaumont.
Oh, that's a Yankee farm club.
At that time it was a Detroit farm club, mm-hmm. And it was a great producer of talent for the Tigers, Greenberg, Rudy York, that type of pitcher or ball player.
Were you with them in Beaumont then, or they came a little bit earlier?
No, they were a little ahead of me. Uh-huh. They were ahead of me by about 4 years. Mm-hmm. I was 1 year behind Bertie Tebbets.
Oh, uh-huh.
During my whole uh-huh. career.
How much did you make a month playing ball for Charleston?
I was pretty well paid. I made $100 a month at Charleston.
That was a little above of average then.
A little better than the average. Yeah.
And you stayed at a boarding house, and meals included, maybe $5 a week?
Absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Absolutely correct.
So you sent all your money back home?
Most of it.
Most of it. Uh-huh. And so what kind of equipment did you use in 1935 as a catcher? Much bulkier from pictures I've seen than what they use today.
The protectors, the chest protector and the shin guards, they called them in those days, and the mask, were pretty much as they use today, but as you just said, Dan, much bulkier. Mm-hmm. And when you were a catcher in those days, you were pretty well tied down by equipment. Mm-hmm. And playing in Texas, and we played day ball.
Yes.
They didn't have lights at the beginning of my career, and it was tough.
And you had all wool uniforms.
Oh, my gracious. Ours were all wool, and they were bright red.
Bright red?
Red uniforms. And those fans, especially in San Antonio, called us the Red Devils. We had a pretty good
team. Was
that
your reputation, or just a...
Well, we just looked like it, I guess. Uh-huh. Dizzy Trout was on the ball club. Floyd Giebel. Mm-hmm. People like that.
Mm-hmm. So you play, let's say, going in the Texas League, you did a lot of traveling around on a bus.
As a matter of fact, we didn't. In
did
those days, we traveled by train. Houston, San Antonio, cities like that, we traveled by train.
So had a little bit better than some of the teams in the Eastern League where they play in small towns, hop on a bus, drive all night, and try to get a few hours of sleep before they went out to the ballpark again. At least you had the luxury of a train ride.
Some of the travels in the minor league today are really tough, mm-hmm. really tough.
Still are today.
Yes, yes.
And so you went with Beaumont, still as a catcher. What did you learn about handling pitchers in the minor leagues that helped you as you became a manager later? Did somebody take you under wing and say, now, Jack, here are the skills to be an effective catcher, and mainly it's managing and knowing a lot about that pitcher, what he can do and can't do?
Well, in the 2 years I was at Beaumont, I had a manager that I feel today was one of the best managers in baseball, although he never got to the big leagues to manage. He became a big league coach. His name was Al Vincent. Tremendous mental giant in the game of baseball. And he helped me considerably.
What did he do that strikes in your mind that makes him shine that much?
Well, we had three or four major league prospects in the pitching department. Neuhauser, Dizzy Trout, to mention a couple. And after each game, Al Vincent would sit down, not with the pitchers, but with me. Mm-hmm. And the other catcher, a boy named Dixie Parsons. And he would go over the ball game and what we did and what we should have done. And as I mentioned, Dan, his mental prowess was tremendous. And I think he helped me more in baseball than anyone. And in 1940, they decided I was a better baseball player mentally than I was physically. And my chance of being in the big leagues as a player weren't too good. And they decided to make me a manager, and they put a team in what they called the Michigan State League at Muskegon, Michigan, and put me in there to manage. At that time, I was 26 years old.
So you weren't that much older than some of the kids on the club. Well, they probably they might have been out of high school, 18, 19 years old.
Correct.
Well, what Al Vincent did he teach you about selecting a pitching sequence? Teach you to keep try to help that pitcher keep a guy on runner on first base?
Just keeping the pitcher alert and studying the hitters and knowing your pitcher, what your pitcher's best pitch was, what the hitter's best pitch was so far as hitting is concerned. And we just went along, and fortunately I was able to retain a lot of that stuff.
Well, did you have from Al, did you have a set sequence that you always wanted to have the pitchers go after? Come in first with a fastball and then with a breaking ball. And if you were ahead of the batters 2-0, make him chase the ball?
That all entered into it. We never had any set pattern. We would sit down before a game and discuss who we were playing and try to work out some kind of a pattern. But his theory was you can't load up young pitchers with too much knowledge because they'd forget half of it while they're out there on the mound. Mm-hmm. And it was up to me to remember what this particular pitcher on any given day was supposed to do.
And so you tried to help that pitcher think.
Right.
You ever see the movie Bull Durham three years ago?
No, I didn't.
This was a catcher in the minor leagues, and he was helping the pitchers get ready to go up to the big leagues. And, of course, a lot of it is embellished and exaggerated, but that movie comes back to my mind. Brushback pitches. Today, big leaguer batters get uptight by the brushback. That was common stock in the trade in those days.
Oh, gee, that was part of the game.
Yeah.
Schoolboy Rowe was on our ball club, 1938. And
this was with Beaumont?
Beaumont. And he was coming back from an arm problem and was making great progress. And he was great for pitching inside. Mm-hmm. And you had to pitch inside. And he hit one of their players one day. And, of course, you didn't have a designated hitter. The pitcher was always hitting. And the first time Rowe come up to bat against this particular pitcher, Clay Touchstone, it was about the seventh inning of the ball game. To show you how Vincent's mind worked, he knew that the first hitter in the following inning, after Rowe had hit their batter, was going to get peeled. And Rowe was the first hitter. So Vincent didn't let him hit. He put me up to pinch hit for him.
You're the guinea pig.
Knowing exactly what was going to happen, I mean, that touchstone buried him.
Get that one. touchstone here, and he was, and you came up to take Preacher Rose's spot in the batting order.
I come up because Vincent knew he was going to throw at Schoolboy Rowe, and Schoolboy was on a recovery program at Beaumont from a bad arm, and Vincent didn't want him to get hurt, but he knew he could get along without me. And as it turned out, the guy did hit me, and a big fight ensued.
Well, did you charge the mound, Jack?
Yeah, I did, because I knew.
You knew what was going to happen.
I knew this was intentional, and he really tried to hurt me.
Yeah.
And in those days in the Texas League, they let you fight.
So the umpires just kind of stayed back.
The umpires stayed back until one guy was getting too big an advantage, and then they would stop him. Mm-hmm. But I picked my spot, Dan, to be honest with you. Touchstone was a smaller guy, and I knew I could handle him. And for about a minute and a half, it was pretty good. But then it was all over.
Uh-huh.
I mean, nobody carried this.
Yeah.
This was part of the game. You had to pitch inside, but today, they don't even pitch inside and guys charging.
Or the umpire doesn't give them the benefit of the doubt, and out they go.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, as a catcher, I'm sure you tried to help the umpire call balls and strikes occasionally. What were some of the techniques you learned in the Texas League that, in those days, probably the umpire had that big balloon chest protector. He probably stood right over your head.
They did. They leaned on you, much like they do today. But in those days, they leaned on you because of necessity with that big balloon. There was never too much trickery involved. You cultivated the friendship of the umpires, something that you don't see today. All the ball players knew the umpires, and if you were a pretty good, decent fellow with them, they would lean over backwards and give you a fair shake. And that was all I was involved. But today, there's so much bickering, and the umpiring profession is such a tight organization that none of that is allowed.
Of course, those umpires were wanting to get up to the big leagues themselves.
Absolutely.
So they wanted to show a good job. They had scouts looking at them as well as scouts looking at the players.
And in those,
you never traveled. So did you travel with the umpires, or did
they, no? They traveled by themselves. I never got that.
But wasn't a crew more or less associated with three or four teams for half the season at least?
Right. They tried to keep expenses to a minimum, and it was two-man crews. And you don't.
Oh,
see
just
that
a two-man
anymore.
Crew.
Just two-man.
One behind
crew.
The plate and one working the rest of the field.
And most of them had big league experience. Art Passarella was in the league. Steve Basil was in the league. Raleigh Naylor. They were all fellas just going up to the big leagues or coming back.
Mm-hmm. I read a book entitled Stolen Season, a fellow that loved baseball. He was a journalist, and he toured a lot of the minor league ballparks. This was about a year ago, and he wrote a book about his experiences. And the reason I bring this up, he said that he had heard this story, maybe completely nonsensical, but it came to my mind as you as a catcher. He said a fellow by the name of when Walter Johnson was pitching for the Washington Senators, and his catcher was a fellow by the name of Ainsworth. And they went into Cleveland one time to play. And Sam Chapman was on the Cleveland team, a good ball player. But Johnson had one whale of a fastball. And so Ainsworth said, let's work a 3-2 count on Chapman. And then you're going to wind up for that after a 3-2 count. But give it your best shot, but don't throw the ball. Let's see what happens. So they do this, 3-2 count. Umpire, next pitch, which wasn't a pitch, umpire says, strike three. And Chapman looking around, what do you mean strike three? That ball was a foot outside.
We never had that.
You didn't pull that kind of trick, did you?
No, but one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life was an umpire. I was managing at Toledo then. We were playing Minneapolis. And my third baseman was a boy named Billy Barnacle.
Oh, yes.
And Pat Padden was the umpire.
Yeah.
And a real Irishman. And a very religious man. And anyway, we had to play at third base. And Barnacle's got the guy out by at least 5 feet. And Patton, he makes no movement whatsoever. And I went out there and I said, Pat, and he was typical Irishman, had an Irish brogue. And I said to him, what's coming off here? You got to give us some kind of a decision. And he says, Jack, he said, I'm saying the rosary and I'm on my last Hail Mary. And as soon as I finish, this guy is out. And he was out.
He was out. He didn't change his mind. Well, he took his time making the call. He didn't call him too quickly, did he?
No, he sure didn't. He sure didn't. So that was fun in those days. Mm-hmm. There's no fun today. You know, umpires that have fun with the players and vice versa. Nothing that took anything away from the ball game, mm-hmm. but it was just something to make the ball game that much lighter.
So after a couple of 3 years with Beaumont, Vincent and others see managerial skills that you have, and so you hang up the glove and become a manager up in Michigan.
Well, actually, I was a playing manager.
Oh, you were?
That was a way that they saved some...
Saved money.
Money. You managed and you played.
Now, isn't that an incredible amount of pressure on a player to be, well, the last one, I guess, I think of Lou Boudreau in the major leagues. Pete Rose, I guess, did it briefly when he came back to Cincinnati.
Bucky Harris for a while. But there weren't too many of them. But in the minor leagues, of course, nobody mentioned pressure in those days. But I imagine in the big leagues it was some. You had to take care of your own job and yeah. and other people's jobs and know what your pitchers were doing. And very, very tough. I don't think you could do it today, Dan, yeah. really.
Well, a manager today has to be a press agent. So you got to
mostly
and deal with those kinds of folks, let alone probably a lot of administrative jobs that didn't even enter their mind, 30, 40 years ago. They say that a ball club reflects the personality of its manager, that a manager has a preferred style of playing and changes it, of course, to fit the available players that he has. I guess you had a personality that reflected the way your ball teams played. Could you give us some thoughts about, what you wanted to see, a style that maybe you learned from Al Vincent or you picked up on your own that kind of guided the way you managed a club?
Well, the biggest thing I learned from Vincent, I was blessed with some of it to begin with, was aggressiveness. Well, we always felt, Vincent, and I say we, the players on the team, that you could pick up 2-3 runs a week by being aggressive and win a couple more ball games a week. And that was the way I managed aggressiveness. And evidently they liked it because okay. they kept me on.
Aggressive meaning running out the infield grounder.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, in those days, Dan, the ball players were a dime a dozen. By that I mean there were so many people playing baseball. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't put out, you weren't around very long. Like today, ball play is very select. You can tell that the way the draft is going, the free agent draft. Not that many boys playing ball as there were in those days, and consequently the professional level. I remember when I managed in Muskegon, there were 56 leagues. And if a boy couldn't make a club in one of those lower of the 56 leagues, he just couldn't play. Mm-hmm. And they told him to go home. But today, they've got boys playing in the big leagues, and I don't want to sound derogatory about this, but who couldn't play AAA years ago?
Yeah, but they're bigger and stronger and faster. Certainly, I mean, you know, I've been around some of these players that... they're 6'3", 6'4", they weigh in at 210, 220, run like a deer.
Well, and
that surpasses anything that happened 30, 40 years ago.
in some areas that's true, but in some areas it's a fallacy. I mean, there was the as a whole, baseball as a whole, the guys are bigger and faster maybe as a whole. Mm-hmm. But when you get right down to a team, they weren't bigger or faster. You take the Yankees with Lou Gehrig, mm-hmm. a giant of a man.
Yes.
Strong as a bull. Yeah. Tony Lazzeri was a big man. Mm-hmm. Koenig, the shortstop, was a big man. Bill Dickey was a big, strong guy. Then you go right to the Tigers. You had Rudy York, and you had Greenberg. And
well, those are both big men.
Those are both big men. As a whole, the athlete today is bigger and faster. Mm-hmm. But he is not smarter.
Well, are they coming up too quickly and not learning the basics?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I was playing, you played, I would say, 6-7 years in the minor leagues before you got to the big leagues, unless you were absolutely outstanding.
A Ted Williams or...
Ted Williams.
Joe DiMaggio.
That type of ball player.
But,
it's changed. And change for the better, mm-hmm. entertainment-wise.
Yeah.
Somebody came along like Bill Veeck and some of his type that wanted to show people that baseball was entertainment. Mm-hmm. And they put it that way.
Exploding scoreboards and clowns and any other thing. I remember when Charlie Finley bought the Kansas City A's from Arnold Johnson in the late 50s or somewhere around then.
That's true. I was in the big leagues then.
Uh-huh. And the old Kansas City ballpark, which had been used by the Blues in the American Association.
Right.
And they put goats out there to keep the grass mowed down on that slanting outfield beyond the fence. And someone told me that Rocky Colavito had gotten traded to the A's, was on the verge of hitting home run number 300. And so Finley said, if you hit number 300 at home, that is Kansas City, I'll give you, what, $3,000 or something. So Colavito was a nervous man anyway. You know, he went through all these gyrations about getting ready to bat. And when he get ready to go to the bat, they had a police car, an armored van out there with all the money. And as soon as Colavito would get up to bat, the sirens would go on and jump and get nervous. Never did hit the darn thing at home. But, you know, that was the entertainment part of it. You start out managing in the Michigan State League in Muskegon. You had, what, 24, 25 ball players to deal with?
Oh, no. We only had about 17 or 18.
Oh, that was the maximum on a roster.
That was the maximum on a roster. This is 1940.
Okay, just before the war.
And you had to manipulate and know what you were doing. Had a lot of two-way ball players who mm-hmm. played different positions.
So you sat down with them, let's say, getting ready for another team. How'd you prep the guys? Talk to them about the opponents that they were going to have that day. You didn't have a lot of scouts that went around
to the other
ballparks. You didn't have pitching coaches. You didn't have hitting coaches. You were it, Jack.
I never had a pitching coach till I managed Toledo in 1951, and I had Tommy Bridges was my mm-hmm. pitching coach.
So you were the whole thing.
You did all that yourself. And on occasions, you drove the bus, and you were the trainer.
You drove the bus too, huh?
Yes, sir. But Detroit was a high-class organization, and they hired a bus driver. But when I was at Batavia, New York, in the early 40s, 43, 44 in that area, I drove the bus. Mm-hmm.
And if there was an injury, you tried to take care of that. So you were kind of the physical therapist?
Right. You were everything in those days. Now, today they got, I know the Detroit organization, and I'm sure the other organizations, they have a trainer mm-hmm. on every ball club. Mm-hmm. They have a coach on every ball club. But the managers you have is a lot easier so far as duties are concerned.
I imagine one thing you've learned as a beginning manager was not to overmanage.
That's the first. Jack Zeller was the general manager in Detroit at that time, and a great baseball man. That was his pet peeve, over-managing. He wanted you to let the kids play and to help them, not to dictate how they were going to play. You let them play, and if they did good, praise them. And if they didn't do well, try to show them why they weren't doing well.
Well, when you say overmanaged, now you're going to call whether you want that runner to steal second.
Hit and run, squeeze plays, steals, all that trick stuff.
You did.
We didn't do.
You didn't do? Didn't,
no, he didn't want you to do that with kids. Did that later on, AA and AAA, but not in the lower leagues.
Kind of let them find out what their abilities were, whether they could really pull it off.
Let them play ball.
Okay, you got a man on first and second, or a man on first, no outs. Got a mediocre ball player. Did you just always give them the take sign, the hit sign, and do what they wanted with it, or did
If the occasion demanded, you bunted. I mean, you bunted. You tried to win the ball games.
Yeah.
But you didn't burden them with too many hit and runs and all that kind of stuff. You let them play, because when you hit and run, you're taking the bat out of the guy's hand. He's got to swing at that next pitch, regardless of where it is.
Yeah.
And he didn't like to do that. He wanted the kids to play ball. Now, as you progressed and they learned how to play ball, then you got into that kind of
baseball. That kind of stuff. But not in that lower league.
Not in the lower
league. No lower classifications.
And in those days, the pitchers weren't burdened with fork balls and sliders and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You just developed the kid's natural talent, and then as he progressed, then he learned different things.
Probably had a good fastball, hoped they had a little hop on it, learned how to throw a curve and a changeup, and that's about it.
You taught him concentration, tried to teach him concentration.
How do you teach? Now, I've coached soccer and baseball. How do you teach concentration other than just telling them to do it?
Harp on it all the time.
Just harp. Don't let them forget it.
Harp on it all the time. And the wheat and the chaff, they separate themselves. The ones that can do it, and the ones that can't do it. And the ones that can't do it fall by the wayside.
Well, that's easier to separate the superstars like, you know, Dizzy Trout and Hal Newhouser as they were coming up from those that couldn't get it over the plate once out of 10 times.
That's true.
But you had a whole mediocre group in there that were not as easily judged.
Well, you didn't bypass them by any means. You didn't ignore them. You tried to help them, too. But you found out early who was going to progress in baseball, and you spent most of your time with them.
Who was hungry enough to learn and follow
That's true. That's true.
So a mediocre ball player who was willing to learn and follow advice could make it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So, all during the war, 1940 in Michigan, the war breaks out. What happened then, Jack?
I went into the service. I was in there a very short time and was discharged with a bad back. And that was the extent. 3 months in Bainbridge, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the extent of my military service.
So you came back to baseball?
I came back to baseball and went to Batavia, New York.
Okay, that's where you were the bus driver?
That's where I was the bus driver.
What league was that?
That was in the New York Penn League.
Mm-hmm. Class B?
It was Class D.
Class D.
Still operating. Today it's operating as a rookie league, and Batavia's still in the league. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking 50 years ago.
Yeah. Still, and that was also owned by the Tigers, so you stayed with...
It was a double working agreement. Mm-hmm. You know, there weren't too many ball players in those days.
That's
most
right.
of the kids were in the military.
Yeah.
So Detroit and Cleveland both furnished players.
Mm-hmm. And you did that throughout the war in Batavia?
3 years.
3 years, okay.
And
evidently someone in the Tiger organization spotted, hey, we got to bring Jack up and in the hierarchy.
Yeah, I was fortunate, Dan. I had two people in the Tiger organization, Wish Egan, a great scout for many years, and Jack Zeller, I mentioned him before, and Wish pitched in the big leagues too.
Egan?
Yeah, Wish Egan.
And what was, he spotted you then?
Well, he was what we called in those days my sponsor. Wishing and E-G-A-N. He was a left-handed pitcher in his day, and he liked me, and I liked him, and he kept me going in baseball.
Is that in relation to Jim Hegan and Mike Hegan, that family?
Oh, no. Wish Hegan was E-G-A-N.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
He was my sponsor, and the minute the war was over and the ball players were coming back, he brought me back into the fold.
Mm-hmm. Aloysius Jerome.
That's him.
Okay. How'd he come up with Wish? Was that a...
Well, it's part of his name, Aloysius.
Oh, okay.
And they called him Wish. Uh-huh. Great man, one of the great people in baseball.
He played with Scouter for Detroit for some 40 years or so.
Oh, yes.
So he was your mentor. He kind of took you in hand.
He was my mentor, my sponsor. He saw that old Jack was taken care of.
I don't hear that term today, sponsor.
Well, it's used. Today they call it a favorite or something
that. So he said, let's put Jack up in the AAA.
No, they started a Class A league in Michigan again, mm-hmm. and they put me at Flint, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And was there 2 years, then went to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. the Eastern League.
Who were some players that you helped along the way when you went over to Flint, Michigan after the war then? Had some that you saw develop into and went on to the big leagues?
Yeah, there was a boy named George Lurchin. Mm-hmm. Bill McDonald went to Pittsburgh. But in those days, Dan, it's funny, it was sort of a weeding out process. By that I mean all these young kids being discharged from the service. And each ball club would have 200 players that had left and went into the service and all come out at pretty much the same time. And they started new leagues, new clubs to let the boys play so you could... Yeah. So you could weed them out.
So you had a lot of veterans coming back, as well as a lot of young kids.
Correct.
And so the gates were pretty well bent out of shape for all the players getting in to...
Absolutely. It was kind of a turmoil mm-hmm. for a couple of years. But then it smoothed itself out, and then I went to Toledo and Frank House.
To stop with Toledo, what year was that?
That was in 1951.
Okay. Now, Toledo had been a farm club of the St. Louis Browns for years and years.
Absolutely right. And when the Browns left them, the Tigers stepped in.
The old Toledo Mud Hens still exist today.
And they're a farm club of the Tigers today.
Mm-hmm. They were always the doorstop, the doormat of the American Association from time immemorial, the way kind of like the Browns were in the American League. Except for they may have won an occasional pennant.
Well, it took a little while for Detroit to get them straightened out down there. Billy Evans was the general manager in Detroit and did a good job. And 1 year we did win the pennant. It was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Won the pennant, and it was the first pennant Toledo had won since Casey Stengel was there in about early 20s. So as you say, a doormat.
Yeah,
it was 40-some years.
40, well, that's... but I remember, which I've shared on other tapes over and over again, that American Association was one whale of an excellent league.
Mickey Mantle was in the league that year.
Yeah, he came in. Came down from the Yankees for a short time.
Willie Mays was at Minneapolis. Yeah. Eddie Stanky was the manager of Minneapolis. Bob Serve.
Yeah, he was with the Blues.
Moncrief. Oh, there were a lot of good ball players.
A grand league, a lot of major league ball players who came down to manage in the American Association mm-hmm. during your time.
Mickey Higgins.
Yep, Louisville Colonels.
And it was quite an experience.
Yeah. Did the managers of the association get together and kind of have a fraternity among you that fellowship, or did you kind of go
not
your own
really,
ways?
Not really. You were friends, but there wasn't any organized group or
anything like that.
Fraternizing off the field. Although I did spend a lot of time with Pinky Higgins, he was one of my all-time favorites.
And he managed Louisville team at that time.
Louisville, and he had Evans that's playing in the big leagues, Baltimore. White Evans and Fisk came down there along that time. And what are you talking now? Those guys got 20 years in the big leagues.
Yep. Indeed.
That type ball player.
Had some interesting ballparks in that American Association, from the little softball field in Minnesota or Minneapolis to the expanses of Kansas City and Indianapolis.
That's right. Minneapolis, they had a pretty good ball club. They had a colored fellow playing there that year named Dandridge.
Ray Dandridge.
Terrific ball player.
Yes.
And as I said, Stanky was the manager, and then a guy named Tommy Heath succeeded him as a longtime minor league manager. And Gutteridge managed in the league. And as I say, Pinky Higgins. And Walter Alston was at Montreal, but Clay Bryan managed at St. Paul. There were some pretty good managers.
A lot of baseball savvy. And Tommy Bridges was your coach.
He was my coach.
Now, Tommy had an erratic career.
He sure did. He had a physical problem. And Mr. Briggs wanted to take care of him like he did most of his old-time employees. And he made Tommy the coach, one of my coaches. My only coach, not one of my coaches.
Well, that was a full-time job, just taking care of Tommy.
Yes.
Be sure he got to the field.
Absolutely. But I'll say this for him. He turned. He straightened his life out and was great.
He recovered and
not said, during that particular year, but a couple of years later. And he lived in Lakeland, Florida at the end of his career.
You mentioned Mr. Briggs, and I, of course, think of the old name of the stadium, Briggs Field or Briggs Stadium. I'm sure you met Mr. Briggs on several occasions. He was of that old crop of baseball owners that his one business was baseball. He didn't build ships or anything else. Baseball was it.
Well, he had an office at the stadium. He was there every day. And Wishegan, getting back to Wishegan, Wish was kind of his liaison man. During my career, coming up in my managing career, Steve O'Neill managed the Tigers most of the time. And,
was he a tough negotiator in terms of salaries? Or
Mr. Briggs?
Or did he get involved in that?
He didn't get involved in that. Jack Zeller and then Billy Evans and George Troutman, he too was the general manager, and Muddy Rule, one of the general managers. But in those days, Dan, unlike today, you didn't negotiate very much.
That's right. Sign this or else.
Sign this or else. You had no agents.
That's right.
And you had a great commissioner. Judge Landis was the...
Well, now, Judge Landis, he stepped down, what, 45 or 46?
That's right.
And then Happy Chandler came on board.
See, I was in with the Tigers 2 years. Latter part of 1940 and all of 42, and Judge Landis was the commissioner, and then when I went back out in 44, 45, Happy Chandler was the commissioner.
Yeah, they went from one extreme to the other. They could only stand Judge Landis only so many years, and I think they probably wanted to get more control of the game under their own belt.
They did. Judge was absolutely too tough for them.
Told him what to do and what not to do.
Oh, he was tough.
It's remarkable that somebody can accrue that kind of power when he is the employee of the baseball owners. But he kept the integrity of the game.
He absolutely did. He came in at a tough time, straightened it out, and in that process gained too much power to suit the owners. Mm-hmm. And along came Happy Chandler.
You associated with, I'd like to come back to the American Association days and the glorious team of the Mud Hens. You also, you did work with a lot of outstanding ballplayers. Hoot Evers, George Kell, Newhouser, Greenberg. Greenberg was probably one of the first kids of the Jewish faith really to break into big-time ball.
That's right.
And I heard he was a very devout religious man. He would never play on his Sabbath or on the other religious holy days if they fell on it during a team, and people respected his judgment.
Absolutely. There was an occasion in Detroit where a very important ball game was to be played, and it was a Jewish holiday. Mm-hmm. And the importance of the ball game meant nothing to Greenberg because his faith dictated this is what he should do, and he did it. And a high-class gentleman.
That's what I've heard.
A high-class gentleman. One of the tops.
This is side two of a conversation with Jack Ty.
Detroit had great pitchers. Schoolboy Rowe, Eldon Walker, Tommy Bridges. And then along came Trout. And Newhouser was an outstanding pitcher.
Yeah. Of course, they were up there all the time with Cleveland and the Yankees and Boston contending for that American League pennant.
Yeah, Detroit did well, Dan.
Yeah.
And one year there was nobody could compete with Cleveland.
Yeah, 48, wasn't it, when they won, which is still a major league record of 111 games. 112 games.
I don't know what the year was, but they were outstanding.
Yeah, 1948, when then they went on to play the Giants,
yeah,
and lost four straight and beat them.
Yeah.
Just took them to the cleaners, just the way Cincinnati did Oakland last year.
I was at that series.
Oh, you were?
Detroit used to take their